Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents House of Purple Cedar by Tim Tingle, narrated by Jason Grazel. A Note Before the Reckoning. Rose, Winter of 1967. The hour has come to speak of troubled times. Though the bodies have long ago returned to dust, too many ghosts still linger in the graveyards. You are old enough. You need to know. It is time we spoke of Scullyville. I was born and raised in the Choctaw town of Scullyville, where I attended New Hope Academy for Girls, till it burned on New Year's Eve, 1896. My grandmother went there too. She met my grandfather when he was a student at nearby Fort Coffee School for Boys. By the time Oklahoma became a state, all of downtown Scullyville had burned. The stores, the businesses, the stagecoach stop, all burned. We knew Nahullos set the fires. They wanted us gone. Almost everyone from that time is dead now, their faces blurred. Their stories scratched like formal words in old, old letters. But once we were alive, all of us, and when good people, Choctaw and Nahullo both, step over Scullyville graves, we sing as best we can. We sing those old hymns and songs, for they were everything to us. Our religion, our joys, even our sins, they all made up the music. We amen at the top of our lungs beneath the brush arbors. We sweat and toil in our gardens and fields and brood over our livestock and our babies both. I am speaking as a dead one now, and soon I will be. No time to waste. This story must be told. To see not only the unfolding of events, but the meaning I ascribe to them, you must know of the vision, for the house of this story is built upon my vision. The dream came sometimes once a week, sometimes not so often, and always in the deepest hour of night, when neither day's end nor dawn cast any light. This vision that I thought was a nightmare began when I was 12 years old. Though many years passed, in the vision I am always 12, always sitting in the same church pew, always with my family in what at first appears to be a normal Sunday morning. Pokanee, my grandmother, has not yet entered the church. I am saving her a seat next to me near the window, where we can both stare out at the swaying trees. Brother Willis reads the scripture in that ponderous tone of his before he lurches into a sermon likely to raise the dead, as Pokanee always said. When Pokanee appears, she walks past our row and approaches the altar, ignoring all else and staring at the wooden wall behind the pulpit. Soon everyone is following her gaze. Even after years of witnessing, I am still startled at the strangeness of the sight. A man, and I thought I might never know who it was, is slumped over and hanging, his clothing nailed to the back of the church. His body is slowly writhing, his head lifts with every breath, and his vacant eyes return our stare. Always when you thought you knew who hung before you, then you saw another. Brother Willis steps aside and Pokanee continues walking, but she now becomes a panther, black and silky skinned. And now she is my Pokanee, then the panther once again. Through all the days of death and suffering, I long to see the face of this writhing one, nailed to the cedar planks of our church. Fire and Ice. Reverend Willis and the Boys. Young Rose, January, 1896. I always feared death by ice, much more than death by fire. Even as a little girl listening to Brother Willis preach about how the world would end, I was never afraid of fire, of burning up. Fire was warm, and if it got to be too hot, you just scooted away. The only real problem with fire was starting it in the morning. Everybody else was asleep, and you had to climb out of bed and freeze your fingers fetching firewood so they could stay curled up and comfy. "Rose, are you up yet?" Mama said every morning, while the moon still shone and the sun hadn't even thought of waking up. The walls in our house were so thin, she never had to shout.
"Is it morning yet?"
Daddy asked, and I could hear him roll over. I knew he covered his head with his pillow to block out the coming day.
"It will be soon," Mama always said. "No need to waste it."
No need to waste it meant they could sleep for half an hour longer, but I better get up and start the morning fire. My grandma and grandpa, Amafo and Pokanee, lived with us too. I guess it's better said we lived with them since this used to be their house. Daddy liked to tell about cutting the cedar and sawing the boards, helping Amafo build this house when he was still a boy.
"I was just a neighbor kid. But I knew if I was a good worker, he'd let me court your mother someday,"
my father used to say. My little brother Jamie always made a secret face when he heard this, but there were no secrets, not from Mama.
"You don't want to be like those lazy Willis boys, do you, Jamie?" she'd say. They get whipping sometimes. You don't want a whipping, do you?
Of course, that never happened to me or Jamie, neither one. We never got a whipping. But the Willis boys did, and always by their mama, never by their preacher daddy. I never liked seeing anybody get whipped, but especially not the Willis boys. I know they gave living Hades to their big sister Roberta Jean, but there was just too many of them to expect anything good. And the how many of them there were, that wasn't their fault.
Even a good man, a preaching man, brings troubles on himself sometimes, Pokeney used to say, shaking her head at the Willis boys.
I remember her saying that very thing one Easter Sunday when the boys stole the baby Jesus from the packed-away nativity box. They buried him in the graveyard by the church to see if he would rise up from the dead during the service. While Brother Willis was telling about how the stone was rolled away, 7-year-old George Willis started hollering.
"Jesus lives!" he shouted. "He's coming out of the ground right now! Everybody, come see!"
What those boys saw was a skunk stirring up leaves around the baby Jesus gravesite, but they didn't know it. They all scrambled out the windows, yelling louder than their daddy ever did. Blue Ned Willis was 5 at the time, and he chimed in with,
"We're going to meet Jesus!"
He said it over and over again, sounding more like his daddy every time. The older boys saw Jesus first and were able to stop, but not Blue Ned. He plowed right ahead, stepping over the rise of graves, dodging tombstones, till he learned a life lesson he would never forget. One of the world's ugliest sights is the close-up view of a skunk's backside, with the tail raised. The skunk sprayed young Blue Ned with a cloud that could be seen and smelled from all the way inside the church. Blue Ned rolled on the ground, rubbing his eyes and crying. As the skunk disappeared into the woods, his brother George remarked,
"Jesus just wants to be left alone, looks like to me."
Reverend Willis simply prayed a closing prayer and waited by his wagon, his head bowed and clutching his Bible, while the Bob brothers and Mrs. Willis handled the situation. Older brother Samuel, sitting on the front pew with his mother, never even turned to see his head to see what trouble his brothers were causing. He soon joined his father on the buckboard. We had been married for over 40 years, Samuel Willis and I, and were visiting what was left of Scullyville one Sunday afternoon. He told me how later that evening, during one of his night walks, he found a rope and a burlap sack in the woods by the cemetery, the sort of sack one would use to tote a skunk. Someone, out of meanness, had planted that skunk to disrupt our Easter worship service. The memories came flooding back, and we both shook with laughter. A very hard thing to do, seeing how the woods had reclaimed our once fine community.
My daddy thought he would never get the congregation back. Every time he spoke the word Jesus, in that booming voice of his, I can hear him now.
Wish we could.
Someone would start coughing to cover up their laughing. But he did it, Samuel said. Oh yeah, he did it. He brought us back. I don't know who laughed that final laugh. I was too scared to turn around. I knew how mad he was getting, Sunday after Sunday. My father leaned over the pulpit and told us all, make your choice. Either get up and follow that hell-bound skunk to the woods, or let Jesus return to his church. But don't be stinking up this temple with your laughter when his holy name is spoken. Nobody laughed after that.
I thought Samuel was about to break out in tears when we came to the clearing where the church used to stand, where his daddy was buried, but he didn't. Samuel just looked at the well-kept graves for the longest time. I never thought they would burn the church, he finally said. At least the church was empty, I replied. The school was full of girls.
First and final days at New Hope Academy. Rose, 1896. Yes, I always feared death by ice, but fire was nothing to fear. You could control fire. The sun was fire. Summer was fire. Cooking? That was fire. Ice was different. It rode the air. It stung everything it touched. Ice killed the corn, stopped the rivers, killed weak animals. On walks in the woods, you could find them frozen dead, their mouths open and crying for something to stop this burning ice. Roberta Jean and I were boarding at New Hope Academy for Girls that year, rooming with 20 other girls. The school was only a few miles from home, but we were young girls. I was 11 and Roberta Jean was 12. We would just be better off staying at school during the week, our parents figured. We were home by supper every Friday and back to New Hope after church and Sunday dinner. While home, we gathered whatever we needed for the next week at school. Clothes, pencils, knitted thread, and needles. A week before Christmas, we moved back home for the holidays. Christmas Eve, we all climbed on a Moffo's wagon and Daddy drove us to church.
For 3 hours, we sang Christmas songs in Choctaw to welcome the baby Jesus. Away in a Manger was always my favorite. Christmas morning, Daddy appeared with a wreath he'd carved from cedar branches.
"I saw Maggie selling them at the hardware store in Spyro," he said, "but I made this one."
The wreath was decorated with red and green ribbons, and he proudly hung it on the wall. When we opened presents, Daddy untied the ribbons from the wreath.
"Rose," he said, "these ribbons are for you, to wear when you go back to school."
"Yucko key, Daddy," I said, and gave him a long, sweet hug. On the last day of December of 1896, the frost was sifting down, heavying the tree limbs with a silvery shine. We arrived back at school in the early afternoon. Tomorrow, New Year's Day, was a grand day of celebration for everyone, girls and teachers too. The boys from Fort Coffee would wander over, those shy and mumbling boys who almost never spoke so you could hear them. We would share our first meal of the new year, 1897, with the boys. The cooks from New Hope would work all morning, according to Roberta Jean, dashing and fussing and frying and stewing, while we girls put finishing touches on gifts we had made for our friends, our boy friends. I was new to the school, and I shook all over with excitement. Since I did not have a special friend, Amafo helped me make a pair of stickball bats for some nice young man.
"Some lucky young man's gonna get 'em,"
my Amafo said, whacking the sticks against each other.
"These make good chance sticks come dancing time."
All the girls talked at the same time, showing everyone what they had made.
Okay, not everybody talked.
I spotted Lily, a shy little girl and tiny as a toddler. She was sitting on the edge of her bed, folding and unfolding a blue handkerchief she had made. She didn't talk. She never talked, at least not so anybody could hear her. Lily was deaf and talked with her hands. I didn't know her kind of talk, but I was learning. I walked to her bedside and she looked up at me. I pointed to the handkerchief and then to Lily. She nodded quick and a bright new smile crawled across her face. I reached out my palms and she handed it to me. I held it to my face and made a big but soundless word with my lips.
"Achukma, good," I said.
Lily nodded and her hands made a sign. "Thank you," they said. I knew that word. Besides Roberta Jean, Lily was my favorite friend at New Hope. She was like my little sister, my sweet and precious Choctaw sister. Dark came early that night.
"Everybody to bed," Miss Palmer shouted. "We have a long day tomorrow."
The frost snuck up on us that New Year's Eve. We were caught without any warm blankets. All we had were the school blankets of thin green wool, worn almost threadbare by years of use. I don't know how long I had been asleep when Roberta Jean woke me up crawling under the covers.
"Too cold to sleep alone," she said,
and her breath floated in the air. She brought her blanket with her and snuggled up close, but she was freezing cold from being out of bed for just a minute. She rolled over, facing away from me. The soles of her feet touched my calves. They were so cold I shivered, but I kept my mouth shut and rode out this little sliver of cold, knowing that in a few minutes her body warmth would feel good and we could sleep like the Choctaw sisters we were. I soon drifted off to dreaming about the most beautiful Sunday of my life. I was maybe 5 years old. The snow fell overnight in fat, light flakes, twisting and dancing outside my window when the moon peeped through. I pulled up the quilts, propped myself up, and watched for hours, moving my palms in a snowfall hand dance, all to the rhythm of the snow. I heard my grandfather creak down the stairs to light the fire. I leapt out of bed, wrapped the lightest quilt around me, and went to visit with him, just me and him. We could have a good talk.
"Rose, baby, what are you doing up so early?"
"Just come to see you, Amafo."
"Well, ain't that nice. You come set your blanket on the floor here by the stove."
Amafo was stoking the fire and, sure enough, he found live embers where nobody else would even think of looking. He pushed and poked them to burning, then turned to fetch more wood from the dog run.
"I'll have it warm before you know it," he said.
I curled up on the floor and fell asleep till he returned with 2 armloads of stove-cut logs. I struggled to my knees to help, but Amafo said,
"You just lay on back. I can do this."
When the fire was cracking and warming through the metal, he said,
"Now, what we need to talk about, my Rosebud?"
I stretched and yawned, smiling at him, calling me Rosebud. "You think we'll go to church today?"
"Well, I think we will. Let's take a look outside."
He scooped me up, blanket and all, and carried me to the front window. We could hear Daddy and Mama stirring in their room, but Amafo just looked their way without saying anything. This was our time. He held me over his belly with his left arm and pulled the curtain back with his right.
Oh, Hamafo, look!
The snow made hills and valleys in the front yard, swoops and dips of purest white, halfway up the tree trunks of the nearby evergreens. To the west, the moon still hung yellow, but the sun was coming up. It colored the snowbanks, pink and pretty as a puppy's tongue. The pine limbs hung heavy with icicles, sparkling and dripping.
Yes, Rosebud, I believe we going to church. Snow's gonna melt by noon. Be mostly gone when church gets out. Be a pretty good ride getting there, don't you think?
I think so, Hamafo, I said. Yes, I think you're probably right. Looks like we'll be going to church. We better tell Daddy when he gets up. Maybe you can tell him?
I expect I better, said Hamafo, carrying me to a nice warm spot by the stove. Now you take a little nap while I make the coffee. How about that, hon?
Okay,
I said, and in less than a minute, I was sleeping sound. The Burning of New Hope. In my dream, I was curled up on the cedar floor, next to Hamafo. The icy chill of morning was gone, and my cheeks now felt the sweet bath of fire. I pulled my quilt down. The fire lapped hot.
Wake up, hon, Hamafo called, shaking me hard.
I did, but I was not at home anymore. I was at school, at New Hope.
I must have been dreaming, I said, stretching and yawning. Wake up! Get up! Hurry!
Roberta Jean leaned over me, hollering. Smoke swirled about her head.
Fire! Everything's on fire!
I was on my feet, and we started running, our blankets wrapped around us. We shouldered down the stairs with the other girls. The teachers pushed us aside and ran upstairs against the flow.
Is everybody out? Is everybody safe?
They said it over and over, but no one answered. We all just ran. Once outside, I stood, clinging to Roberta Jean, shivering and watching the skeleton of our schoolhouse crack and fall, bone by bone. It finally heaved a shuddering breath and fell into itself. A flock of small flaming boards flew in our direction. We dashed to the woods, brushing embers from our blankets. This was not the fire I knew. There was nothing warm and calming in those yellow and blue flames. I was watching ice, cold bitter ice, come to life, rising from the frozen flames to claim our school. We were driven by fire to freeze in the ice.
Lily! Lily! Lily!
The calls rang out through the mad darkness and fiery light.
Lily!
Why does that lady keep screaming Lily's name? I asked, covering my ears.
Make her stop. It's her mother, said Roberta Jean. Then she knows Lily can't hear her.
Those words floated back at me, and I heard them for the first time. I stared at my own breath. Beyond my breath, I saw the flames, like flicking and mocking tongues. Lily Chukma, good Lily, was deaf. She could not hear her mother. She could not hear the calls to leave the building. She slept like the 7-year-old baby that she was. So watchful and eager to please. So very, very deaf. I dropped my jaw and my face quivered. I tried to scream. Tears flew down my cheeks, tears that will never stop flowing till I see her at Judgment Day and wrap my arms around her. I will tell her how sweet she was and is and how much I loved seeing her every morning. How much I loved kneeling by her bed for prayers each night.
Lily,
I finally sputtered when I had the breath to sob. Roberta held me closer and we pulled the blankets over our heads. Our knees shook and buckled and we drifted to the ground to sit in the melting snow, a dark green cone of wool and skin and bones and life, while all around us swirled children and teachers and Nahullos and Choctaws and Cherokees and Christians all. But their running meant nothing. Death by fire had claimed Lily Chukma. It was the Bob brothers, Ephraim and Ben, who lifted the rafters from our fallen smoking room and found Lily's body. Ephraim raised the roof when Ben kicked aside the still-burning boards to find her charred and fetal tiny body. They gave it over to the Reverend Henry Willis and he carried Lily Chukma to her mother. Roberta Jean tugged me after her, and we shuffle-stepped to stand behind Mrs. Chukma. She took her daughter, Lily Chukma, took her in her outstretched arms, all the while staring at Reverend Willis. Finally, her gaze settled on her baby. When she spoke, her words spoke the night.
Mother should not have to bury a child.
This tiny scene was played out for only a few of us. The rest were running to render aid only to feel the biting flames that claimed our school. My chest hurt and my lungs ached. I knew that something truly was breaking apart as I stood and watched, wounded by the biggest loss of my life, the loss of New Hope Academy for Girls. We turned our backs on all of this and walked as the unseen dead might walk. Through smoky fog we walked, Roberta Jean and I, floating against the stream of urgent runners, drawn to their own drowning vision of hope. We wrapped our arms around each other's waists, muted by our grief. We returned to our small encampment and wrapped the blankets over our heads. We fell to the moist ground and went to grabbing and clutching at each other, first our hair, yanking and pulling, angry pulling, on whatever gave good holding place, arm or foot or ear or skin of thigh. We clenched our fists and flailed away, crying loud and biting even, all the while knowing we did so in the name of love, the only love still granted us in this, the most perverse of bleeding worlds.
The Funeral and Ephraim Bob, January 1897.
Ephraim Bob was a stonemason. He was trained by his father, who was himself a master mason. From his early teens, Ephraim displayed, to the immense delight of Mr. Bob, a feel for stone that is impossible to teach. He matched stones for the sheer beauty of their porous skin.
"Every stone," Ephraim said, "has its own way of speaking to a man who'll listen."
The first time Mr. Bob heard Ephraim speak of listening to a stone, he stood up and stared at the back of his son's head. Ephraim closed his eyes and ran his fingers over the grainy calluses of rock, the slick, unbroken whisperings of stone. Mr. Bob shook his head in wonder. His eyes filled with tears and he whispered a prayer of thanks for having such a son. As Ephraim grew, he matured in every way but height. 5 feet 5 inches tall, he moved with the ease and grace of a small man, though his girth was anything but small. The daily pounding of his mallet chiseled Ephraim's torso into a gaudy specimen of muscle, a tree stump with a belt and breeches. His hands hung well below his knees. Mr. Bob was so proud of Ephraim, he often flung his arms around his son to show his joy. The two sometimes boxed, slamming their fists against each other's hardened stomachs. Seeing this, a way so counter to the tribal norm, kinfolks and friends would quietly laugh and mock the two. Ephraim was 17 years old when Taloa was born to his father's sister.
"She'll be as pretty as her mother," his father said,
standing over her cradle and smiling big and broad. She was not named Taloa on her birthing day. That name would come soon enough. The Saturday following Taloa's birthday, Ephraim and his brother Ben accompanied their father on a buying trip to the hardware store in nearby Spiro, a Nahullo town. They bought cattle feed and a new mule harness. While Ben spoke to loud-laughing Maggie, who ran the store's affairs, Ephraim and his father stood on the sidewalk.
"Son," his father said, "we need to talk about something."
When Ephraim turned to face him, his father swung a hard left fist and struck him squarely in the navel.
"I can still kick your butt," he said. "That's what we need to talk about."
It was the last thing his father ever said to him. As Ephraim doubled over, his father spotted a spike in the middle of Main Street.
"Somebody gonna get hurt," he muttered, stepping from the sidewalk.
He paused to let a mule-driven wagon pass. The lead mule stepped on the spike and lurched, loosening the strap from a 100-pound barrel of flour. Ephraim stood helpless on the sidewalk and watched the barrel roll from the wagon and strike his father in the head before slamming into his chest. From 20 feet away, he heard the sharp and brittle crack of ribs beneath the crushing weight. Ephraim leapt to his father, lifted his broken body, and laid him on the sidewalk. A jagged piece of rib had pierced his father's lungs, and he drowned in his own blood. The next morning, Ephraim carved the tombstone for his father. Little Taloa, barely a week old, cried and cried with the grieving women at Mr. Bob's funeral. Thus they named her singing one, Taloa in Choctaw. Following the burning of New Hope, Ephraim was asked to carve the gravestones for the 20 girls who died. The morning of the burial ceremony, he visited with grieving parents and family members, many of whom had traveled several days to attend the service. Beneath a shady grove by the gravesite they gathered, huddled in blankets from the cold. As he stood to speak, Ephraim's eyes settled on the dark clumps of earth rising from the ground and the bundled bodies in the 20 wooden coffins. Steamy fog hovered over the fresh dug holes.
"All respect will be given in the cutting of the stone," Ephraim said.
Mothers and fathers nodded and cried softly, surrounded by their living children. They looked at Ephraim, who stood with his head bowed, holding his broad-brimmed hat in both hands and rocking slightly. Fat tears rolled down his cheeks, and he made no move to hide them. Ephraim's 10-year-old cousin, Taloa, they knew, was among those who died. Rose. As we neared the graveyard in the early morning dark, we passed under the arms of fat-trunked sycamore trees. Through the gray branches we could see the shapes of wailing women, their long black dresses, their heads covered with black scarves that hid their faces. My father pulled our wagon to the roadside and eased to a slow halt. Whiteface stomped the ground and munched on brittle sycamore leaves. We sat for a long while before descending into the world of grief. My father took off his hat and closed his eyes. The old women howled and fell to the ground. When they rose again, their singing cut the day in half. There were 2 days, the day we lived in, ate in, slept in, smiled and cried in. Then there was this day of grief, a day I never knew before. Nothing was like before, nor would it ever be. Unlike most funerals, with the wailers grieving for us all, many of the wailers on this day had lost a grandchild in the flames. Their cries took on a purple undertow of deeper grief. Mothers of the dead joined the older woman, as they had never done.
"Minty! Minty!" a mother called. "Come, my baby, come!"
The sun came into view to the east, and her cries took on an urgent air as if her baby girl was lost and wandering in the woods. The mother grew more desperate as the sun threatened to rise and devour her baby, just as the fire had done. My father stepped from the wagon and lifted Jamie and me to the ground, then helped my mother, then Pokani and Amafo. By the time we stepped through the trees, the sun was casting yellow rays on the graves of my newly dead girlfriends. A swell of anger took hold of me and shook my body till I could barely stand. Pokani reached from behind me and held me by the waist. She laid her head on my shoulder, and there we stood, leaning one upon the other. I parted my lips and breathed in the gardenia fragrance, as much a part of Pokani as her thick black hair. Brother Willis always stood so strong, but on this day his whole body sagged, from the skin of his wrinkled cheeks to the knees of his breeches, still muddy from his night of kneeling and praying in his garden. But when he lifted his eyes to the Choctaw gathering, the coming light took hold. He pulled a hymn book from behind his back and became the man we knew. If ever I have had, in the course of all that I have witnessed in my 84 years, reason to doubt the presence of the good and living God, I only need turn to the doings of Brother Willis on this sacred day of mourning to restore my faith in the everlasting.
"We will sing a hymn before we hear the word of the Lord," he said.
"O come, let us adore him," he sang, and how could we not but join him? O come, let us adore him. O come, let us adore him. O come, let us adore him, Christ the Lord. For he alone is worthy. For he alone is worthy. For he alone is worthy, Christ the Lord. He sang a Christmas song of adoration of the child, and how could we not but join him? Standing all together, the living and the dead, how could we not but join him? Am Enshil Alela Oklat, Holy Toblet, Taloa, Chitoli, Kaho Haklo, Clolia, Clolia, Excelsius Teo. Oim Ila Momit, Oim Ila Momit, Oim Ila Momit, Ho Tushpa. I marveled at Brother Willis and how he took us from this world. Then the song was over. He stumbled in his words, and before he could announce another page number, Amelia Chukma cried, "Ooh," and everyone stood shaking and crying. The crying was deep and good. We wailed and looked into each other's eyes and sobbed out loud. I never felt so free to shout my grief, and many others did the same. As if called to join us, our gone-before Choctaw kinfolk covered the graveyard. Through my watery eyes, I saw people standing by their own graves, holding tight to their families. I saw 1,000 Choctaws, dead and buried long ago, and all of us were weeping. Brother Willis let us cry. He stood with his head bowed and his cheeks shone with tears. We stood for what must have been the better part of an hour, and then his voice boomed with the scripture reading. Following the singing of funeral hymns, we carried our baskets of food from the wagon. Grape dumplings, roasted corn, beans and onions, banasha bread, and 2 large kettles of pashofa. Other families brought chicken and strips of pork, fried and boiled. Mr. Folsom backed his wagon up the dirt roadway and pans of food were placed at the wagon's rear. Pokani put her arm around me and led me to a cluster of women gathering to begin the serving. Elder women came first, then men and boys, and young women and girls. The usual feasting talk gave way to quiet sobs. I saw Samuel Willis, even Samuel, lift a finger to his cheekbone and trace the path of a fresh tear. Samuel was distant as the dark he wandered through, but on this day, the rolling bones of his face were home to shiny tears. I sighed and wished my fingers, too, could touch his face. I turned to Pokani and she wrapped her thin, strong arms around me. Later, after her death, I found myself thinking that she caught my looking at Samuel that burying day. She felt my sighing, and more than that, she saw the home we would someday make together, Samuel and I. My gift of seeing came from Pokanee. Of this I have no doubt.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?